fugitive must be a rolling stone. Down every road there's always one more city. I'm on the run.
All right, authentic fugitive music here, and I selected this myself. Hi, everybody, talking fugitive with Kitty and Bobby, and I am the Harry Von Zell of KSAV, Dave White, here to get them set up and off for the next 30 minutes. So without more of me, and on to them, the moderators of the Fugitive Views and Reviews. Not bad, only about 4 or 5 months I got the name right.
Here,
I got it right. Here's Kitty and Bobby. Go ahead.
Hi there.
Listen, before we get started here, and because I'm afraid we might run out of time at the end of the show, I just want to wish you and Kitty and the people listening a Merry Christmas and a Happy New Year.
Well, thank
same,
you.
I don't same for me.
With. That's not get done today. And I have a question for you, Dave, and that's... where does that song come from? What's the title of it? Because somebody asked me about it, and I don't know anything about it.
Ah, well, at last we get into something here that I know about for a change. I believe that was a Merle Haggard song, and I think the name of it was The Fugitive, either that or Lonesome Fugitive, I think it was called, as Lonesome Fugitive.
Wow.
And I actually recorded that off of a 45 RPM record, so that gives you an idea of how old it is.
Yeah, because somebody had asked me what that song is, and I said, never heard it, to tell you the truth, but it's certainly fitting.
Okay, good. Well, thank you.
All righty. 2 weeks ago when we were on, we started a discussion about Helen Kimball and about why she's so rather underdeveloped in the show and why she is treated so negatively. And we actually received 4 emails. I only got to one of them. I'm getting a lot like you, Dave. I'm letting these emails pile up and not getting to them.
Yeah, get you into trouble.
I'm telling you.
Yeah.
So I want to get to that right away at the top of the show here because we want to wrap up this subject today and move on to something else in January. We got, like I said, 3 emails were not read, one from JC, one from RC, and one from Linda. They're all members of our group, and I'm going to put Linda's aside for a minute because she said she might try to call in during the show tonight. The one from JC is rather long, but I've just picked a couple of parts out of it. He asked in his email, why is Helen Kimball so underdeveloped? And he writes, the writers treated the series as an anthology because the format was devised that way. The Girl from Little Egypt, the story with all the flashbacks, made its writer Helen's God, giving the only flesh for Helen's scrawny bones. Do we want more? Of course. Quinn Martin, Roy Huggins, Alan Armour, the people responsible for the show, or whomever should have established the Richard-Helen relationship in the initial story guide and kept it a recurring thread. How often did Kimball say he was seeking revenge for his wife's murder? No, it was always to save himself from execution. Is Helen important? Of course. There is no story without her murder. Is Helen treated negatively? The problem is she's barely treated at all. Then he asks, was her murder her fault? Something I've asked in the past. And he answers it by saying, no, she was an innocent victim of blind violence, a little play on words from the opening credits in the show. I like that line, but I would change it a little bit to read, no, she was a not-so-innocent victim of blind stupidity, because actually I think a lot of this story is really her fault. And that's why when I say she's treated negatively, I say it that way, because at the beginning of the story, it's her argument with her husband and her pigheadedness and not seeing things his way that causes him to get angry and leave the house and leave the door unlocked, which he does, which sets off the murder in the first place. And but if we can skip all the way from there, from episode number 14, to the end of the series, 4 years later, to episode number 120, the second part of The Judgment, that's the next time that we get a flashback to her again. And this time, this is the flashback that they use to explain why there's a witness at the end of the series that sets up Kimball being exonerated.
Bob, Linda's on the phone anytime that you want to call for her.
Okay, let me just finish a few things here,
okay,
and then we'll go to her. So we get to the final episode, and we see her in the bedroom, and she's clearly drunk and more out of control than ever. In 4 years, she hasn't been rehabilitated. She's even worse. And she's yelling and hollering about Richard leaving the house and how she's sorry for it. She hears noise coming from downstairs, and she goes to investigate and walks down halfway down the steps and sees the one-armed man ransacking the house. And instead of running back up to the bedroom, locking the door and calling the police, she goes and struggles with him. She doesn't have a weapon or anything. Kitty, we talked about this the other day. How stupid was this for her to do this?
Oh, yeah. Well, to me, it kind of flies in the face of logic, because I think any normal woman, I mean, unless she's been highly trained in jujitsu, you know, who could easily go kick some guy's ass because her hands have been registered as lethal weapons, or if she's packing a gun, I think a normal woman, if she saw some total stranger in her house, would run up, would do that. She'd go, oh my God, she'd run up the stairs and lock herself in a room and try to grab a phone to call 911 or the equivalent back in 1963. You know, so yeah, I always thought that when I saw the judgment, she runs down the stairs and then she actually grabs him. You know, I never got the impression when I watched that it was ever the one-armed man's intention to kill her. He was just trying to get her away from him because she grabbed him. And he picked up the lamp to, you know, he was fighting her off. A good defense attorney could have made a plausible defense of self-defense in a trial. And, you know, he might have actually gotten away with it or have been found guilty of something like manslaughter 2 with a very minimal sentence.
Well, you know, at the very end of the series, when Kimball is with the one-armed man at the top of the tower in the amusement park, and he's pummeling him and saying to him, you killed her, didn't you? And finally the one-armed man says to him, yeah, I killed her. She wouldn't stop screaming. She'd like to have clawed my eyes out. Which is interesting that a killer is actually using that as self-defense. I had to kill her because, after all, she was fighting me off. But this is an example of how she was treated so poorly. And in essence, I think they really are blaming the entire thing on her. After another 106 episodes, things aren't any better. She's more drunk. She's more out of control. And she's still doing things the wrong way. And it begins in The Girl from Little Egypt, and it never lets up. And I have to keep wondering why it is they needed somebody to blame, and they decided to blame her. Everybody seems to think that the writers seem to think she's the fault of it. It's only her husband that doesn't seem to see it that way. So, that to me is a prime example of her being treated in a very negative light. And I think it's very unfortunate, but if you're going to do that, at least flesh out the story a little bit. All I see is a woman who's drunk and out of control and unreasonable and won't listen to anything and does everything wrong from the very beginning.
And that person in the email, I think, too, brings up a good point as well with Richard Kimball, in that you never get the impression that he's out to seek justice for his wife.
No.
He's out to clear his name. I mean, it's almost, you know, again, it's that we heart, so far, as I've said, in 60 episodes, I've only seen one episode where he has any remorse that she's dead or that he has any guilt that he wasn't there to save her.
And
the rest of the time, it's like he's just mad that he got blamed for it.
And that was totally turned around in the 2000 remake of the series.
Absolutely.
Where he was actually out for revenge.
Well, I don't know necessarily out for revenge, but definitely out for justice.
Yeah.
And, you know, and you got that feeling as well in the movie with Harrison Ford, too, I think.
Okay, Dave, let Linda in on here.
All right, Linda, welcome to Talkin' Fugitive with Kitty and Bobby.
Hi. Good to talk to you guys, finally.
Yeah, you too, Linda.
I finally got a good connection. A brilliant writer of the team that ended the 2000 series. Congratulations on that story. It's great.
Thank you.
Yeah.
We enjoyed doing it, huh, Kitty?
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, I had a couple of comments in my email. I agree that Helen was treated poorly, but I always thought it was because they were trying to make Richard look good. And to lay the blame on, well, they had to show that there was a reason that people believed that he killed his wife.
Right.
Unfortunately, they chose this poor marriage relationship as the vehicle for doing that, which, as you said, in the movie and in the 2000 version, they had a loving relationship, and they used something else to convince the jury that he was guilty.
Well, I agree with you, because when you think about it, it's almost ridiculous that here's a very well-respected doctor, obviously, who, and we see in the season one episode, Home is the Hunted, when he goes back to see his family. They're very well-respected. His father was a doctor, and aside from his rather wayward brother, everybody seems to like the family. So why would anybody believe that this doctor, all of a sudden out of nowhere, simply killed his wife? There is no motive. There's no insurance policy. There's no other woman. He's not having an affair. Nothing is going on. So I agree with you. They had to come up with something. So, but I think what they came up with is rather lame, that, you know, that people, the jury believed it because one woman next door heard them arguing, and that's the reason for the entire thing. But you're right. In your email, you said that she was just a catalyst for everything that came along, and I agree with you. You're right.
Yeah, it seemed like, you know, in the pilot, they didn't really care about the relationship with his wife, and I think you've commented that on the boards plenty, where they threw him into this situation where he's a fugitive, and they didn't care about providing a backstory until people apparently expressed interest, and then they had to make one up. I sort of get the impression that, you know, that wasn't a concern initially. You two know that Ballad for a Ghost is one of my favorites,
and
I really do feel that that's the one point, as Kitty says, in the entire series where he actually seems to convey some remorse. But
I feel like even though Helen isn't present in the entire episode, the beginning where he's her look-alike,
and so you kind of get a mirror image of what his relationship with Helen was, and I think David Jansen did a really good job of conveying that he loved her just by the way he treated the look-alike. And
well, actually, there's another scene. I have two other emails that I'll get to after the break, in which people point out to me a scene in Landscape with Running Figures,
uh-huh,
in which he talks about the early days of their marriage. But in your email, you did mention about Ballad for a Ghost, but you also mentioned the survivors and how you resented or objected to the negative way Helen's entire family was portrayed.
Well, that's true, because, you know, they portrayed the mother as being obsessed with one daughter to the total exclusion of the other, and she apparently set her daughter's bedroom up as a shrine before she was murdered, which I thought was bizarre.
You know, I didn't realize that until I read your email. I thought that she had set it up after she was killed, but she actually set up the bedroom when she got married?
Well, they said she had changed
the thing in that
room
since
Helen got married.
If a kid leaves and you do something else with the room, it's kind of unlikely that you would change the room back. I mean, but then again, the mother was a little strange in that episode.
You're telling me that she changed the bed?
Yes, and that's what I resented, that not only was Helen treated poorly, but the whole family was a little bit dysfunctional.
Yeah.
All right, let's take, Lynn, you can hold on if you want to. We're going to take a quick time out. It's
okay.
Just to promote one of my favorite stations, KSAV, and then we will be back in about 60 seconds and pick up where we left off.
All right.
Talking Fugitive on Retro Radio.
This Christmas, give the gift that lasts all year. Tell your friends and family about KSAV and how to find us. Besides in-depth discussions of The Fugitive, KSAV offers great programming 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. The retro radio format plays the music of the 40s, 50s, and 60s, interspersed with old-time radio programs, retro commercials, and the memories of radio stations of the past. The fun and laughter of Sidewalks of San Francisco, the nostalgia of Perfectly Frank, the guests and audience interaction of Talkin' Television with Dave White means there's definitely something for everyone. Giving the gift of KSAV means no hassles with parking, returns, or exchanges. One size fits all, and the best part of it is, it's free. KSAV, the enjoyment of Christmas Day every day of the year.
All right, well, this certainly isn't Merle Haggard. I think this is somebody we're all more familiar with. I want to tell everybody that after Talking Fugitive tonight is going to be Perfectly Frank, which is turning out to be a very popular show. And at 7:30 Pacific time tonight, Talking Television with Dave White, one of my favorites. That guy is good. And it's going to be the programs of Rod Serling and The Twilight Zone featured tonight. The Fugitive, which you're listening to now, will return on January the 10th at 6 o'clock Pacific time right here with the same star-studded cast. All right, Kitty and Bobby, you go ahead.
Linda, okay. Are you still there?
I'm still here. I don't want to monopolize your time.
No, that's okay.
I
like talking to you,
now,
Linda.
What you were talking about, actually, you said that one of the few scenes, if not the only one, where Kimball is showing love for Helen is in Ballad for a Ghost. But both J.C. and R.C., who wrote to me on our last program, pointed out a scene in Landscape with Running Figures. In the second part, near the end, when Kimball and Marie Gerard are talking to each other, and of course, neither knows that the identity of the other, and she's temporarily blind. And they're sitting in this abandoned restaurant, in this abandoned town, and they're discussing the small town they come from. And she asked him about his marriage and about whether or not he was happy back then. Because, of course, she's so upset about her husband abandoning her once again to go chase after Kimball. And she asked what happened to his marriage, whether it was divorce or abandonment or whatever. And he says it's just an act of God. He doesn't really go into details about it. And she asked if they were happy. And he starts to tell a story about their very, very earliest days, how they didn't intend to get married right away, but that his reserve unit was called up for Korea, and so they decided to get married, and they went to San Diego, which is, I guess, where he shipped out to go to Korea, and that there was no hotel rooms there when they got there, for some reason. And so Helen had to stay in the YWCA, and he tells this cute little story about how he had to leave her there, and he kissed her goodnight at the door, even though she was his wife, and he gives that famous David Jansen little upturned smile that we see so often. And she presses him, and she wants to know, were they happy or not? At first he tells her that it's been so long ago that he can't remember. And then she presses him on that and says she can't imagine that, you know, you can't remember the early days of your marriage, that he would forget. And he says, I didn't say I forgot. I simply said, I don't remember. So he tells this story, and he says, I guess we were happy then. And when he finishes the story, again, he says the same thing. He says, I guess we were happy. Now, my question to you, Kitty, and to you, Linda, is, since you're both women, is that good enough for a woman to hear her husband say that he thinks they were happy? Shouldn't he be a little more positive than that?
Well, yeah, you'd think he'd be more enthusiastic, because this is supposedly when they were first married. Usually people, when they're first married, are very happy.
Yeah, so both the writers of the email say to me, well, that, you know, that's proof right there that it's a very touching scene. But even in that scene, he doesn't appear to be that positive that they had a happy marriage at any time. So, I mean, it's again, it's the same old story of not, you know, I don't think there should have been a flashback at that instant. I don't think that would have been appropriate in that particular episode. But again, you know, where do I get, people keep telling me they had a very good, loving relationship at one time. And this is based on the fact that in the first scene in The Girl from Little Egypt in the hospital, where he's holding her hand and telling her that they lost the baby, he starts out by saying, I love you. Well, okay, that's all very nice, but it's really the only time that there's anything definite coming from him about how he really feels about her. And that, and this just, you know, this kind of thing goes on. And as Linda pointed out, you know, even when he's telling the story in the car in Ballad for a Ghost, where he talks about leaving her alone and all of that, you know, I think that may be just some remorse for running out of the house. And Kitty, you did mention a few minutes ago about while Linda was talking about the end is but the beginning,
mm-hmm.
where he talks to Amy about how he regretted that night.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that to me was showing more remorse than he was showing in Ballad for a Ghost. And that's, you know, for me, the end is but the beginning is the only real episode so far that I've actually seen him do some real lamenting and grieving over the loss of his wife.
Right, and this is where the whole business that I've been mentioning from the very beginning with this underdevelopment comes from. And I just think it would have been a better story overall if we had seen them. The story about being in San Diego and about, you know, not being able to find a room and being together but still separated is a great story. Don't you think that would have made a nice flashback?
Yeah.
Bobby,
Linda, are you still there?
I'll just make a couple of comments. I agree with Kitty. If somebody said, I guess we were happy as a wife, I would be pretty insulted. I mean, you either know you're happy or you're not.
Yeah.
And something else you just said, now it slipped my mind already what I wanted to say.
That's all right. Things I say go away from people's minds quickly anyway. That's not unusual. But, so I don't really see. I just wanted it to be a little more poignant than it is. And, you know, it doesn't. People say to me, it doesn't hurt the series. It doesn't destroy it or anything. You're nitpicking about that. And I agree. I mean, I can easily overlook it. It doesn't bother me all that much. It just is whenever I see those. And it's only those few stories because she disappears for the entire series. It's not like you're reminded of it over and over and over again. Linda, you said in your email to me, you said that scene in Ballad for a Ghost where Kimball is discussing that night and how, you know, she was alone, you said, I think that was far more effective than actual flashbacks of their happier moments, although
well,
I'll probably get disagreement on that. You'll get some disagreement from me. Because television is a visual medium. I mean, this isn't radio. This isn't a novel where you have a character relating a story from the past. This is television. Don't you really want to see it?
Well, actually, I thought Jansen's acting conveyed it.
Well, yeah,
even though
he is good
we didn't
at that.
See them.
Yeah. Yeah, but in TV, it just seems to me, at least maybe not so much back in the 60s. But today, in today's TV world, you know, it's important to show everything, whether it's the news or whatever it is. You know, you have to have visuals with it. And I just always really kind of miss that. I mean, they hired a professional actress in Diane Brewster to play Helen Kimball. It's not like it was just some, you know, stand-in or, you know, to play the part or to just lay on the floor. So they might as well have used her, and they really didn't do it. And I just think that's a pity, but I'm willing to admit that they once had a happy relationship, even though he seems anything but sure about it. And I just think that there is something missing there.
You know, Bobby, the other thing, too, of what I think is a disservice to Helen is that, you know, in the final episode, we find out Helen died because the one-armed man picked up a lamp and hit her over the head with it. And
are you sure that's how it was done? Because they can't seem to make up their mind.
Well, see, that's the other thing. This is the other disservice to Helen, is that how many episodes have we seen now where they keep harping that Helen Kimble was strangled? And, you know, that to me, if somebody is strangled, that's an act of premeditation. And, you know, why is it all of a sudden they decided to make the one-armed man look like he was defending himself against this crazy woman? And I mean, I think if we had actually seen Helen Kimble really get strangled, you know, maybe if we could have seen a flashback of her where she was sitting in the kitchen trying to sober herself up and just berating herself for being so horrible, and then this guy breaks into the house, sees her, and strangles her. You know, I think you'd have more sympathy for this person.
You know why I think they changed it? I think somebody, and I don't know this for a fact, but I think they may have started to think to themselves, is it logical that a man with one arm could really strangle a person? Is he that strong that he can use one hand?
Well, he seemed to be. You know,
well, I don't have any
strong enough where he could pick up a lamp and hit her hard enough to kill her.
Well, yeah, but, you know, to strangle somebody with just one hand, I'm not saying that it can't be done. Probably has been done by somebody. But, I think they may have been a little worried about that, that somebody would question whether that was possible. So, you know, it doesn't take much effort to hit somebody over the head with something, even if you've only got one arm. That may have been why they changed it. I really don't know. But I have to say, I really like Helen Kimble. I don't have anything against the woman. But I really have to say that when I look at all of the evidence, that it's pretty much her fault, the entire thing. I mean, if she hadn't been so stubborn that night, her husband wouldn't have left the house. He wouldn't have been so angry, so that he would have been there. You know, when he talks in Balfour Ghost about her being alone, you know, that's his fault, but it's her fault because she drives him out of the house. And then to simply go down and investigate when this very seedy-looking one-armed man is in the house, instead of screaming and running up. You know, how about if she just starts screaming? How about that neighbor who testified at the trial that she always heard them arguing? You think she would have heard any screams that night?
Well, I always got the impression that that was what the neighbor was commenting on in the trial, that she heard her screaming.
I thought it was maybe earlier when they were arguing with each other.
Right, but I also thought she was commenting in the trial that she heard Helen screaming at the time when she got killed.
Oh, so you're suggesting that would have been Richard killing her and she was screaming. Yeah, well, that's a good point.
Right, because initially, when she ran down the stairs, doesn't she run down the stairs yelling, "Dick, is that you?"
Well, yeah, because she's up in the bedroom and she hears a noise. She's very distraught because she realizes that she drove him out of the house and that he
right.
may not come back. So she hears noise downstairs and she runs down to investigate, which I can understand. I mean, that's logical that she would have done that. What's not logical is to see the one-armed man while you're still in the stairway and continue to go down there like you're going to be able to fight him off. Because I don't think he would have done anything I think he would have run out of the house.
Yeah, I got that impression, too, that's what he wanted to do, was to run out of the house.
All right, well, we're going to have to run out of the house. We have run out of time. Linda, thanks a lot for calling and being on the program.
Thanks, Linda.
Bob
thanks,
and
Linda.
Kitty, we'll see you in, 2 weeks? 3 weeks, I guess it is, on the 10th. This will give you time to prepare for another interesting episode. The rest of you, stick around. Perfectly Frank, and now there's going to be some important program announcements on that, too, because there's some new guests coming up on Perfectly Frank next year as well. And after that, the flagship program, Talkin' Television with Dave White. Thanks a lot for joining in the discussion, everybody, and stay tuned here on Retro Radio.